Okay, it's about 10:15 on the 8th of August, and I'm here in Petone with Graham Claridge. And if we can start, if you could tell me a little bit about the circumstances through which you came to be involved in the McMurdo Dry Valleys and research there.
It's rather interesting, actually, because way back in 1964...
Don't move this a little closer.
Might be a bit closer.
Yep.
Way back in, was it, 1959... There was an International Soils Conference in Madison in 1960. And my director, the director of the organization I worked for, was going to it. And he wants to present a map to the conference saying that New Zealand had done work from the equator to the pole. Because, of course, we had done a lot of soil studies in the Pacific Islands.
Yep.
And Antarctica was the next big thing. So they managed to wangle it so they would send someone to Antarctica to do... produce a soil map.
This was the soil survey, was it, of the DSIR?
The soil Bureau of DSIR.
Yep.
And anyway, so they picked a guy, an experienced guy working in the field of soils, but he needed someone to look after him, you know, just someone a little bit more mountaineering experience than he had. So they picked me and said, you're going to the pole.
Right.
So that's how we went down. And our function was to produce this map. We hadn't the faintest idea what we were going to let ourselves in for. I don't think the people were very concerned. They just two people let them cope for themselves. So we got to Antarctica, got to Scott Base, and they said, "What do you do?" So we need to wander around on some ice-free ground. And they said, "Oh, okay. What about the Taylor Valley?" I said, yeah, that's all right. So we agreed to it. So in the end, we worked out a plan. We spent about a month there. The idea was to go across the McMurdo Sound using tractors, same sort of tractors as Hillary used on his way to the pole,
yep.
Which was the means of transport in those days. We set up a camp at the mouth of the Taylor Valley, in New Harbour. And then we had to walk up the valley and carry our spades and samples and tents. If we had a fly camp, had a couple of fly camps up there, and came back, and we produced a soil map. We couldn't understand it, you know, it was a complete mess because we didn't really know what was going on. And we tend to get away from soils. We couldn't see anything in the soils, but we could see the difference in the geology of the tills. You couldn't work that out. Why the heck should we get kenyite scattered all through the lower Taylor Valley when the only kenyite outcrop we knew was over in Cape Royds?
Yep.
Anyway, so we produced a map showing these differences, with sketched in from aerial photographs and our own holes and things like that. And I collected a lot of samples. And I've actually found a little bit of interest in the soils and themselves. So we pitched together. We produced about four papers on there.
Right. That
work. But I wasn't satisfied. I thought this doesn't seem to tie in with what other people have found. The Victoria University had been in the Wright Valley.
Yep.
And they said, I don't think I can see any relationship with what you see and what we see. So I said, right, we've got to go back again. In 1964, I suggest put up a proposal that we look at five different locations on through the Transantarctic Mountains, from Cape Hallett in the north to as far south as we could get. And lo and behold, they gave us all five that we asked for. I thought we might be lucky to get one or two. We got all five, so we went to Hallett, which was accessible in those days because the big base there was flights every day.
Yep. Was that a New Zealand base? That was an American base.
Yep. A joint base, actually.
Okay.
It was mainly there because of the emergency landing field.
Right.
Because in those days, you see, the planes were a little bit less reliable.
Yep.
And if they couldn't make Woolley Field, they could probably make Cape Hallett.
Yep.
So the Americans were there to establish the airfield. And the flights every two or three days, so we could get up there, and we went there, and then we went to Inexpressible Island, which is about halfway down, which the Chinese are wanting now, I believe.
Yep.
Anyway, we spent a couple of weeks there, travelling by old-fashioned men, man-hauling sledge. They chucked us out of a DC-3 somewhere on the, out in the ice hills, you know, over there, trachea sledge and goes. So we did that, and we wandered around there, and then we came back to, got as far south as the Shackleton Glacier, where someone was working. We get a transport there, and then back into Victoria Valley.
Right.
So we spent a couple of weeks in the Victoria Valley, which is, and that gave us quite a few clues. We wrote quite a lot of papers about that trip, and we really got a...
Who was that with? Was that Ian with? Campbell. Ian Campbell, right.
And we sort of formed, he was assigned to go with me at that stage, you see.
Okay.
So we formed a partnership and we worked pretty well together. And then we just carried on from there, kept on putting up more proposals, getting more and more places. And I continued working into the Dry Valleys and all through the Transantarctic Mountains, wherever we could get to.
Yeah.
And writing about it until... Well, DSIR collapsed about 1988, 1989, something like that. And
yep.
Ian Campbell and I were out of our work, thrown out, redundant. But we still had a research grant. So we managed to still keep going to Antarctica as retired people. And published quite a few papers on the work that we could do without laboratory facilities. Because when I was working for Soil Bureau, I had laboratory facilities, see, so I could.
Yeah.
And my main interest in those days was clay minerals and salt and salts in the soil.
Yeah.
Which I could use analytical facilities for. But after I lost that, we sort of got stuck a bit into soil moisture.
Right.
All you need is a drying oven and a balance.
Yeah. So that was the transition when DSI
folded
and it was beginning to move to Christchurch and that. So that takes us neatly into the next, just in sort of the work in general that you've done. How many trips in total have you made down to the
Dry Valleys? I reckon it's about 15. I've sort of lost count.
15 trips.
I can't really remember some of them. I started to work it up. I remember the earlier trips. But then, of course, we just kept on going back, you know.
Yeah.
I was trying to analyse my photographs, and I felt I couldn't quite work out when they were taken. The later ones.
Yep. And you've talked about how you worked as part of a small team with Ian Campbell.
Yeah.
The funding was mostly coming from the New Zealand government.
Yeah, oh, yes. Correct.
And how would you describe the work as mostly national with New Zealand focused, or did it have any international dimensions to it?
Well, I suppose in a way, as it was national, we were working as part of the New Zealand program.
Yeah.
We made contact with other people like George Denton and other workers, but we weren't working with them until right towards the end. I think we got tangled up with the LTR people.
Right. Was that with Diana?
What's her name? Ian Campbell was doing most of that liaison at that stage, but our work then became relevant to what they were. What they were doing, because at that stage, you see, we had a pretty fair idea of soil process and what was going on.
Yeah.
And from as far as we could see, from their main interest would have been salinity, you see, because it's the salinity of the soil which governs the biological productivities.
Yeah.
You know, saline stuff doesn't grow, but where the moisture's right and the soils are not too salty, you can get algae and other stuff growing in it.
So that's moving on to the next question and the results of your research. If you had to say relatively briefly what the major results of working in the Dry Valleys were, would it be related to the salinity or?
Well, no, just general relationship to the soil. We published the book, as you probably know.
Yes.
You probably got it somewhere, but that summarised most of our work at about, say, book is 1988. So that covered most of our work up to then, and anything we did since didn't really change much. We got a bit into soil contamination.
Right.
because disturbance. Because there's something you can do just to do by observation. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a few papers on that. We were involved in the cleanup of Vander Station.
Okay.
We tied up a little bit then with the Geological and Nuclear Sciences. Another guy, Doug Shepherd, came in with us, and he had contacts with GNS. So we could then get trace element analysis done and pollution studies. And
right.
And we published a few odd paper on the movement of stuff. We got right into Marble Point was a place we found very interesting. You realise Marble Point was where the Americans were going to build an airstrip.
Yep.
You probably know all about that. But they'd been working, and it was 1980 or 56, 57. Mm-hmm. They'd trying to build this airfield, and they'd had bulldozers everywhere over Marble Point. Yep. And then walked off and left it. So we could come back 30 years later. Say, look, here's this tractor. We know when this tractor track was made. And you can see how it's changed or not changed.
And what were the findings from that? That it was very slow recovery or?
Very slow recovery indeed. We also went back into the Victoria Valley because in our work in the Victoria Valley, of course, our early work, we didn't bother about filling in the holes we'd dug or anything like right. that. You don't know it's ever going to come here again. It doesn't matter. So we went back 30 years later. And found some of the holes that we'd dug.
Yep.
And you can say, well, we know what it was like when we left. We actually might even have photographs of it. And see what changes have taken place. Which is some. I think one of our papers is dealing with that mm-hmm. subject. So that's the way it went. So mainly a matter of taking an opportunity to do what we could do at any time.
Yep. And with the soils, I've heard it said that some people say that they're not real, they're not really soils in the dry valleys, and then other people dispute that. Where do you fall in those questions, or are they no longer relevant questions?
Well, this is a question we ran into with editors of journals, for instance. Right. They'd say, now, what's all this about? It can't be soil. So our answer was that if you take the soil forming factors of and reduce organic life to almost zero, you can say not quite zero, but almost like approaching zero. Mm-hmm. And this is what the Antarctic soils are like. So they are soils, and with the organic factor at zero, and the editors eventually would accept that.
Right.
And now, of course, that they've the LTR program would do more detailed work on biological life. There's quite a lot of life in the soils.
Yeah, the nematodes and the rotifers.
Yeah.
So that leads on to the next question. One other question related to question three is, did you see the results of your scientific work leading into broader developments in terms of the policy change, management of the dry valleys? Were you very connected with any of those developments?
Well, yes, because One project we did was a little thing, formation of tracks. Mm-hmm. And people thought we were mad at one stage because we were just walking backwards and forwards. But what we were doing was just looking at what was happening to the track as we walked along it. And so if it did such change, after 50 times you saw certain effects, after 100 times you saw more effects.
Was that in Taylor Valley or Wright Valley?
Well, actually, a lot of it was around Scott Base.
Scott Base, okay.
And over in the Wright Valley.
Right.
One of those sites over there. So we could get some idea of how much disturbance you get by walking on the ground and how much disturbance you get by campsites, for instance.
Yeah.
And I think this has led to a certain amount of instruction to people on how to behave, you know, stick. Don't tread on the soft stuff. Try and tread on the stones.
Yeah.
And clean up your campsite and replace the stones you disturb and all this sort of thing, which you didn't worry about earlier on.
And that leads very nicely into the question about changes since so you've worked there for a long period of time, and what are the changes that you have observed taking place over that time in both the physical environment of the dry valleys, but also in the ways that people think about the environment down there?
Well, I think they're much more careful of it. You know, I'd say we weren't all that careful at all. Because of the, we were more coping with the environment rather than living with it. People are now probably now better able to attune to coping with the environment, managing it, not polluting it, which we didn't worry about. Things like that in our day. But they suddenly realise it's got to go on. But there's more and more so much more and more development all the time. More and more people, bigger camps. I mean, the LTR thing, as I've seen in the distance, you know, you quite extensive campsites.
Yep.
So all this is causing disturbance.
Yep.
And you can't be sure sometimes of what effect you're actually having. It's hard to say, but I think there are much more regulation of field parties than there was in our day. I mean, earlier you just went out and they chuck the two of us out somewhere and
get on with it.
They'd come back in a few days or whatever.
And so you do see the increasing activity, the increasing science that's going on as having a material impact on some of the soils.
Sure it has a material impact, yes. Well, I don't know. We went to, thinking around Marlborough, around Vander Station, for instance, the extent of the contamination due to the base, the activities of the base is quite extensive. Mm-hmm. You know, we were scratching around and digging a hole, looked a bit disturbed. All of a sudden, you're going down a little bit, suddenly find painted rocks.
Yeah.
Someone had emptied a paint tin, which nobody worried about in the first instance, perhaps. You know, you just wash your brush and check the stuff out and throw a bit of gravel over it. But it was all there.
And the next question five, and some of this you've covered already, but in terms of the logistics and sort of getting to the valleys and the administration of the science and the policy, you talked about the DSI closing towards the end of the 1980s. Can you talk a little bit about those changes in logistics and administration of the science as you've experienced it?
Well, there's all the regulations, special scientific areas of special scientific interest and things like that will come in.
Yep.
Like, as I said, we spent a couple of weeks in the Barwick Valley, for instance, which is now strictly forbidden to enter.
Yep.
Which was very good from that point of view, because we could come back to our sites that we know no one's been here because they're not allowed to be here.
Yep.
And we got special permission to do so.
Right.
It was a bit harder in those days. We were dropped in the middle of a helicopter and we could walk around. But then the next time we had to go on the walk from the boundaries in, making as little as possible. Didn't say, well, there are our footprints from 30 years ago.
Well, you could still see them.
In places. Which shows how things do last.
And do you feel that these changes have been generally positive, the site's scientific interest and the management?
Well, I think that they are positive. Because if people had gone on the way we used to go on, the place would be really pretty messy all around now.
Right.
See, for instance, this is not in the Dry Valleys, but way back down in the Scott Glacier, we were two parties, we split. So there were six of us in that stage going down the Scott Glacier by Moses Wogan. And then we split. And They went one direction, we went the other. And we came coming back. We weren't quite sure where they were at this stage. They were camping, and all of a sudden, there was a shower of paper bags and stuff like that. And it turned out what they had done. They were actually camped a mile or two away down the slope. And they'd taken the tent up and just shaken the tent and all the soup packets and just
left it flyaway.
They'd been tucked in the between the two layers of the tent. And when they packed up, they shook it and it all just blew away. And lo and behold, we were upwind for it.
Which year was that? Can you remember?
Dear. About 69, something like that.
Okay.
68, 69.
Late 1960s. And it sounds as if, with some of these repeat sampling visits, that you've been thinking historically about the research. And one of the questions that I'm asking people as a historian, trying to think about what history can offer to the Dry Valleys, science in the Dry Valleys, do you see any ways in which a better understanding of our human history in the region might be able to inform scientific work that is taking place there?
Well, I really don't know. I mean, we know there's a long history of research in the Dry Valleys, going right back, of course, to Scott in 1902 or whatever.
Yep.
But I think the more people know, there comes to be a point in the end, how much more do you need to do?
Yes.
I mean, it's hard for scientists to say that, but after a while you find you're repeating what other people are doing or have done.
Yeah.
And I think it should be possible to find out what people have done. Maybe some sort of register.
Yeah.
So that you can say, well, someone puts up a project or wants to do something, oh, yeah, but 25 years ago, so-and-so did exactly that.
Yeah, I was looking at the Dry Valley bibliography yesterday in the National Library, and I think that was an attempt to do something like that. But I guess with the literature exponentially increasing, it's difficult for scientists to keep up. So much
being done. I mean, I found a problem with our book. I thought, well, it's actually 50 years since we first went there. And we were going to thinking of doing something with it, say, marking the 50 years. And I thought, right, the thing to do is to revise the book. But it just got beyond me. I mean, trying to catch up without any access to libraries anyway. So I can snatch a few photocopies of papers. But,
yeah.
But, you know, that what was I going to say? You need to know, but we now I've got confused. So what was your question again?
For scientists to understand what has been done before.
Well, yes, people need to know what has been done before. We thought that when we wrote our book, which is just on the bookshelf over there, but you've probably seen it. Tried to cover all the knowledge up to the point at which we wrote it, which turned about quite a few years before it actually got published.
Yeah.
as is the way with things like that. But, so it was supposed to be not quite up to date when we were. But if you could redo that and say, well, this is what people have done, then you can say you don't really need to go and redo it.
Yeah.
Unless you've got and can learn something more from it.
Yep.
I mean, one of the things you can do, for instance, is, as I have tried with various things, is our interest in salts. We didn't have studies on isotopes or anything like that, using which help give some idea of the process.
Mm-hmm.
But other people have been working on it since, so that you could re-examine material with new techniques. I mean, there could be techniques that are completely unheard of even now, but
yep.
Could be useful.
Yep.
So you need to be able to say, well, if you found out something like the isotopic composition of nitrate in soils, which is one of my nagging interests. And then but you might say, got to get an easier way of analysing it, perhaps.
Yeah.
So that you could get more detail.
Yeah.
So you go back and read.
And that would justify.
That would justify the work, but to someone to go and say, well, we just redo what someone else had already done, mm-hmm. would be a waste.
Yeah.
And unless you can do more, well, I have tried with for instance with a nitrogen isotope thing, tried to persuade people that it might be worth looking again at, because what little information you've got in this particular aspect, it starts to confirm some of my ideas, and some of them don't. In fact, it did this, well, I was associated with GNS, but we did some of that, and my opinion of the results was that there were two separate oxygen isotope ratios in sulfates and nitrates, and they were completely opposite to what each other.
Yeah.
So I thought, I said, there must be something wrong somewhere. You've got a sign wrong, one of you think. Oh no, they're quite convinced they were right. But that's something that needs to be checked out on. But anyway, that's just one of the things you need to know what people have done.
Yeah. To then build on that and then constructively. Build on it.
Yep. You don't need to do what people have done. Again.
And then my final main question is in a few sentences, how would you sum up what the Dry Valleys and work in the Dry Valleys have meant for you and for your career?
Well, it turned out that it was what I did for the last mostly what I did for the last few years of my working life. Because I was working on clay minerals and soils, Pacific Islands and places that do quite a lot of work in Pacific Islands and things like that. But I always kept on coming back to Antarctica. And since I was retired in 1988 or something, 89, it's been my main scientific interest.
Right.
I could try and follow that and try and keep up with the literature. So not in every aspect of science. So I've concentrated mainly on Antarctica. You know, and hoped to write. That's only a couple of years ago. Managed to get a paper out. So there's still stuff to be.
Are there things that you can deduce from the soils in the Dry Valleys that are then useful for understanding soils more generally?
I think so. I mean, I think we now understand a little bit more about weathering processes and clay mineral formation, which in soils.
As a result of research?
As a result of our work.
Yeah.
I don't know. Of course, with the LTR, they're concentrating more on biological things, which I don't know anything about. So, but I'm sure there's progress that can be made there. But then you take into account what we've found and use that as a guide to what you might find.
Mm-hmm. And then just the final question is, are there other questions that you think would be good to ask, or is there anything else that you would like to add?
I don't think so. I think there's, all I can say is I am interested in what's going on,
right,
and what people have found out. If I can find it, get hold of it. Sometimes I can. Well, it just comes back to it. You want to know what people have done.
Yeah.
And there comes a time, I think, when we might have found out everything that we can find out about the soils of the Dry Valleys, which leads back into the history of the Dry Valleys and the formation of the Dry Valleys, and what has happened, you know, in the 15 million years or so since they were created. Which is, you know, we are getting more and more understanding about it. And I think that there will come a time when you really think we know most of the features of what how they were formed and why they are ice-free. And and what's likely to happen to them as climate change too.
Yeah, that's one of the big questions.
Because that's a big problem. Are they going to warm? Are you going to get more melting? A lot of some papers I've seen about thermocast and the landscape changes, but that would only come about. You need to know how much moisture, how much ice was in the soil, to work out what's happening. If it warms, in some cases, if it warms, it have no effect at all because you wouldn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
But in other cases, other places, you might get completely different changes in topography, and I believe this sort of is showing up to some extent.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. I'll stop the recording there. That's 30 minutes, which is perfect.